Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Unauthorized Disclosure Podcast. I'm Kevin Gastola, and I'm joined by the show's co-host, Rania Kalik. Hey, Rania.
Hey, Kevin.
And we're very pleased to have as our guest a lead researcher for Food and Water Watch. His name is Oakley Shelton Thomas, and he recently worked on a fracking plastics report called The Fracking Endgame, Locked into Plastics, Pollution, and Climate Chaos. So thanks for joining us, Oakley.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And this is a really critical report. I suppose we should say, for people who are unfamiliar with Food and Water Watch, that you're working for an organization that has done a lot of work in the last 10 years on fracking, natural gas fracking, and has called for a fracking ban, been at the forefront in the United States of calling for a ban against fracking. And then now this report looks at the issue of how industry has locked people into having fracking and this dependency. So why don't we begin by talking about what people might not be aware of, which is how even as people are calling for an end to natural gas fracking, we're actually seeing a boom where there's more and more fracked gas-fired power plants that are springing up around the country and that are making it an entrenched part of our energy economy.
No, that's exactly right. So there are 364 new gas power plants in some point of planning and construction underway right now. And that's in addition to 333 petrochemical facilities that are also going to become an outlet for this expansion of natural gas and around 50 new LNG export facilities. And overall, that's going to support about a 25% to 30% increase in gas production, in natural gas production. And most of that's going to be fracked gas production by about 2025. So that's a huge amount of new fracked gas at the very moment when we need to be transitioning away from fossil fuels and fracked gas especially.
And so this is also accompanied by the fact that you've got this plastics industry, which the natural gas industry has taken advantage of. And this plastics industry is something that it's basically using to prop itself up, as documented in the report. Would you get into this issue and how they're really kind of intertwined at this moment?
Yeah, they have a symbiotic relationship with one another. So in addition to dry natural gas, fracking also produces large quantities of natural gas liquids. So these are longer hydrocarbons like ethane or butane, and they're key inputs in plastics manufacturing. And plastic is sort of the ultimate source of demand for frackers because lots of the plastic, or I would say most of the plastic that we use now, is largely unnecessary already. So sort of the sky's the limit in terms of how much plastic they can turn their fracked gas into. And we're looking at what could be as much as a 40% increase in global plastics production over the next decade. And obviously, that's going to support fracking and the attendant infrastructure and environmental risks and health risks that come along with that.
Well, what are some of these risks that you were finding through your research as you looked at this plastics boom? People do know some of the basic details, I'd imagine, of what can happen from natural gas fracking, but what were you finding is happening in these communities where the symbiotic relationship has developed?
Basically, every stage of plastic production is dirty and has negative health consequences for people who interact with it. So at the around the petrochemical facilities themselves, these are incredibly polluting. They have large emissions of ozone precursors, of volatile organic compounds, as well as chemicals like formaldehyde. And in communities that see large-scale build-out or have sort of a large established infrastructure of petrochemical production, there are heightened rates of cancer. I mean, some of the cancer rates are astounding. If you look at the Gulf Coast, where there are a lot of these refineries, but also petrochemical facilities in parts of Louisiana and Houston, it's sort of, it's got the moniker Cancer Alley just because of how high the rates of cancer are around these facilities. And then obviously once the plastic is produced, it breaks into smaller chunks. I mean, it doesn't decompose, but it breaks down into little pieces and then it ends up basically everywhere. And it acts as a vehicle for the dangerous additives that they put into it to make it sort of like fire resistant or soft. And those additives are pretty toxic when ingested.
And I realized that as we're looking at this boom that, and also this issue of becoming locked in, what we're seeing is that an area or region of the United States that is well known to people as being impacted by coal is also going to continue to bear the brunt of environmental injustice. You highlight what's going on in Appalachia. So is it through your research, were you finding that a lot of the areas that the coal industry had taken over is now being replaced by this natural gas and this plastics industry, this relationship?
That's definitely true in the corner of what is West Virginia, Ohio, and Western Pennsylvania, where there's this new storage hub proposal underway that would support up to 9 of these petrochemical facilities. Each one of them could produce as much as like 3.5 billion pounds of plastic every year. So that's going to be a huge environmental footprint. And obviously, they've already been dealing with the environmental footprint of fracking in that area and of coal extraction. And they have that sort of intergenerational burden of what is now over a century of coal production that's polluted waterways and poisoned communities. So the addition of this new burden, rather than transitioning away from fossil fuels, is really, it's really sad, honestly. So that's why we're fighting it.
What's the backlash? Like, is there a backlash, I guess, is the question, from the communities that are being impacted? Or are they like, so I know a lot of these communities, you know, the coal industry has shut down or is shutting down. And so people are probably desperate for jobs. And I imagine this opens up the opportunity for jobs. So like, are people pushing back because of the toxicity of these facilities, or is it the opposite? And, you know, is the government playing a role in helping the industry build more facilities like this?
Yeah, there's definitely pushback. And I think that something that people in these communities know is that industry can't be trusted to be safe. It doesn't have a good track record of being clean. And obviously, as these facilities are closing, there's reason for people to question the durability of these investments and the promises of jobs getting brought to these communities, which is why organizations like Food and Water Watch are organizing with real people on the ground to fight the build out and to fight the infrastructure. But they're also getting a lot of help from government, and they're getting lots of tax subsidies. There have been various handouts in the form of direct subsidies, as well as tax breaks and tax exemptions and complicated write-offs. I don't want to get into the weeds on. In the Appalachian Storage Hub example, they're applying for a federal clean energy loan guarantee through the Department of Energy. That's a $1.9 billion loan guarantee. And the program is supposed to be going towards clean energy. But in this instance, it's going to support dirty energy and ultimately plastics production. So Food and Water Watch is fighting. We're pushing for an amendment to what is a minibus bill in the House that would stop and block the DOE from issuing this loan guarantee and ensure that clean energy loan guarantees only go to facilities that are actually clean and actually result in a decrease in climate emissions.
Now, just a couple basic points that I think are worth establishing for people. So when we're talking about the natural gas, we're talking about methane emissions. Can you speak to how maybe we might be addressing the issue of carbon emissions, but now we have these methane emissions coming from this industry?
That's exactly right. So methane is the primary constituent of natural gas, and it leaks pretty much everywhere across the supply chain. And the production of the natural gas, so when they're extracting it, it migrates up from the fissures that are created from the fracturing and from flowback. Then when it's transferred through pipelines, when it goes through compressor stations, all of these facilities vent some amount of natural gas or cracks leak it to the atmosphere. And the ultimate impact of this is more than the carbon emissions that come from the natural gas when it's burned. So ultimately, these methane emissions make the sort of overall footprint, if you look at it holistically, of natural gas worse than that of coal, especially in the short run, which is the time that matters the most given the urgency of the climate crisis.
And so keeping in mind this urgency, one of the other things that the report mentions, I mean, it's a basic detail, but it seems so crucial for people to take note of, is that the report says that the new gas plants are supplementing rather than replacing some of these coal-fired power plants. I mean, we've been led to believe by a lot of politicians that the coal industry could be replaced by this more safer energy source in natural gas, but it's going to accompany coal in, or the industry imagines that it could exist side by side in some communities.
Yeah, I mean, I think their dream is to just produce more energy that powers more industrial facilities that produce things like unnecessary plastics. So they're ultimately, they have these sort of grandiose demand projections. But I think the big takeaway from the sort of coal versus natural gas is that debate, supposedly, is that it's a trick of moving the baseline. We're in a very fortunate position of not having to choose between coal and natural gas because technology to support a renewable transition that's backed up by things like batteries to store the energy. The technology is just ready. It's cost competitive and it's being blocked by established industries. But if we had the political will, we could roll that out and we wouldn't need either natural gas or coal.
And then let's just take a moment here. One last area in this report that is part of what Food and Water Watch did is to look at how there's a gas glut. You can explain to people what is meant by that. But there's a huge part of the industry that's relying on exporting this to the world. And that's propping us up and locking us into climate chaos. So why don't you address that aspect of the report?
Yeah, so fracking has almost become a threat to itself by producing more gas than they know what to do with. They have driven down prices and it's eating away at their profits. So rather than fracking less and producing less gas, in response, they're pushing for more sources of demand that will both raise prices and increase the amount of fracking that they can do to bolster profitability. So one key emerging area is liquefied natural gas exports. So we can export by pipeline. That's relatively straightforward. But in order to export natural gas across oceans, it has to be super cooled to negative 260 degrees and compressed to many times its natural volume and loaded onto these mega carriers. And that's a rapidly growing industry. Just in the last 2 years, between about 2018 and 2020, it's hard to keep up with because of how fast it's growing, but it's basically tripled from about 3.6 billion cubic feet of gas per day in terms of the capacity that they have to export to. By 2020, it's going to be about 10 billion cubic feet of gas per day. And all of that's going to keep growing, and it's going to make it very challenging, even if the United States transitioned away from natural gas, if we just export it abroad where it still gets burned. That's not going to be a positive climate contribution.
And so one thing we've been led to believe, though, is that this boom in energy in the U.S. is going to decrease our dependence on foreign energy resources, and so we need to be doing it. But your report would seem to explode that slightly, if not entirely, by showing that a lot of these communities that are bearing the brunt, they actually aren't going to be using this energy because a lot of it is going to be exported. Is that sort of something that you sort of dealt with in your research?
No, that's very right. And I mean, if they wanted real energy independence, the solution is renewable energy because there's not a limit to how much sun or wind the United States has access to, but there are limits to however much of any fossil resource that the United States has access to. And in terms of natural gas production, it's somewhat ironic because we were told that we needed fracking in order to lower domestic prices of natural gas and to bolster domestic energy supplies. But now they're extracting, the prices have gone too low and they want prices to increase. So they need to extract more of it more rapidly to deplete supplies at a faster rate in order to drive up prices, which is totally counter to the original narrative. Not that we thought that they were being honest or acting in good faith originally. It was obviously a ploy from the get-go, but now it's just shown to be completely wrong.
And one of the recommendations that is made by this report is that we would stop having government institutions bail out or fund this dirty infrastructure. Can you speak to like any examples or like from doing this work? Do you is it quite extensive to in the way that the government is actually supporting and helping to prop up and allow this industry to maintain itself?
So it gets really complicated really quickly. The clean instances are ones in which there are direct tax subsidies or tax exemptions or things like the federal loan guarantees. But for power plants and for pipelines, there are authorizations of cost recovery because they're granting basically monopoly rights to use of these resources at sort of specified rates of profit. This enables monopoly utilities to recover the cost of maybe unprofitable assets long after their economic lifetimes, so long as they're like haven't recovered the total cost. It's a thing that the government does in order to create sort of cost certainty for investors to support them. And that ends up being a huge handout. And it's going to be a more important issue, I think, going forward as we have to close these facilities early and they start closing before they're able to pay back their investors the amount the investors wanted. And then there's going to be a lot of calls for bailouts of the facilities themselves. So we want to head that off in the pass.
All right. So how about one last question here for you is, you know, you worked on this report in your research and I guess I'm curious, you know, I don't know what kind of knowledge you brought to exploring how locked in we were into this climate chaos if we continue to depend on these industries or prop up this industry. I didn't really know much about how plastics factored into natural gas, but perhaps you maybe want to speak to, you know, anything you found to be alarming or stunning to you in the process of putting together this report that you think people really need to take away.
I think the key is that these facilities last a very long time. The companies that are building these facilities expect the facilities to operate for decades. Facilities like these facilities have been operating for half a century to a century. And if we drill now, if we build these facilities now, they're going to get locked in and stuck there. And it's going to be very hard to close them. I think that if you look at the industry projections for how much gas they expect to be using and line that up to what kind of climate change that looks like the upper end of 3.5 degrees Celsius or more in terms of warming is consistent with their demand projections and what they expect to be doing. And I think that's really terrifying. I think that's a key takeaway that we need to get mobilized and we need to fight back. We need both people power to stop these facilities, to stop fracking, and to transition to renewable energy.
Well, Oakley, I want to say thank you for joining us to do the show. It was really great speaking to you, and a lot of this work is critically important. So we're thankful that you were able to join us to help us follow and talk about this issue.
Thank you for having me on.